This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is supported by FX's Clipped, the scandalous story of the 2014 Clippers owner's racist remarks captured on tape and heard around the world. The series charts the tape's impact on a dysfunctional basketball organization striving to win against their reputation as the most cursed team in the league. Starring Lawrence Fishburne, Jackie Weaver, Cleopatra Coleman, and Ed O'Neill. FX's Clipped, streaming June 4th, only on Hulu.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Ed Pulford, one of the hosts of the channel. On the podcast today, we have Ian Johnson, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning author and journalist who's worked in China as a correspondent for the New York Times, New York Review of Books, and Wall Street Journal. And he'll be talking about his new book, Sparks, China's Underground Historians and Their Battle for the Future, which was published last year, 2023, by Alan Lane. The idea that history matters in China is enough of a commonplace that it is sometimes dismissed as a lazy stereotype. What contemporary state is there, some might ask, that doesn't rest on historical claims promoted in education and media and adopted by populations as a lens through which to understand their place in the world? We only have to look at the many conflicts which are currently raging around the world for devastating evidence of how history is entangled with political agendas in many places. Yet even on this background, China seems to stand out, not only as somewhere where state and people are preoccupied by history, but also as a place where this preoccupation has its own long history. History, in other words, is full of people thinking about history. And, perhaps most importantly, powerful people trying to set strict guardrails around which historical narratives predominate. It's this latter dynamic in the present day, as the Chinese Communist Party under General Secretary Xi Jinping seeks a monopoly on historical truth, that forms the crucial background to Ian Johnson's new book, Sparks, an extraordinarily rich and beautifully written account of the filmmakers, artists, writers, and researchers who've shouldered the challenging burden of pushing against state-led efforts to forget inconvenient chapters of the past. Based on years of research, decades of deep experience of Chinese society at large, and evidently personal relationships with many of the figures discussed, this book not only gives us an inspiring account of the remembrance and documentation project it discusses, but also asks intriguing questions about what history actually is, or what it's forced to become under far from ideal circumstances like those that the PRC's underground historians face today. So here to reflect more on all of this, and I think hopefully many other things, is the author himself, Ian Johnson. So I'll say, Ian, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you. Thanks for that introduction, which it succinctly clears up many points that people often ask about, such as doesn't history matter in our own countries and so on, which it really does. And for pointing out some of the differences in China.
Well, yeah, I think it's a starting point in some respects for the book, and I guess it's, you know, it's always a conversation that one slides into just because of the delicacy of trying not to essentialize or simplify the fact that, you know, history exists everywhere, or that, you know, conversely, some places seem to have a more prominent historical consciousness or something. Anyway, we'll get into perhaps some of these questions about why it matters. But We'll perhaps begin by asking a few things about the background to the book. It's by no means your first, of course, concerning contemporary Chinese society and its intersection with politics and so on. So could you say something to start us off about how you settled on this topic and how the book came about?
Yeah, it's a book I probably wouldn't have thought that I would have written, say, 20 years ago or something like that. I guess when I first went to China, well, first went as a student in the 1980s and later went as a journalist in the 1990s, I was much more interested in purely grassroots phenomenon, like, you know, the people I wrote about in my first book, Wild Grass, Folk History, or peasants, farmers, and so on and so forth. But when I went back to China around the time of the Summer Olympics in 2008, shortly after I started a Q&A series for the New York Review of Books, which is still on their website, called Talking About China. And the first person I interviewed for this series, at the instigation of the editor of the review back then, Bob Silvers, was Yang Jisheng, the great independent Chinese historian whose book on the famine, Tombstone, and also on the Cultural Revolution really set the standard for this movement of underground, or unofficial might be a better word, historians in China. And that got me thinking. I went back to China to research a book on religion and faith and belief in China, which I did write in 2017, called The Souls of China. But even before that was written, I was already starting in on this book, because the two are in some ways interrelated, because they're both about how you solve the problem of China's authoritarian malaise, the former group seeing it as a spiritual quest and the others seeing it as a more political, historical quest. And so as I worked on this series of Q&As over the years, it went on for about 10 years, this issue of history kept coming back over and over again. And this was even in the Xi Jinping era, because most of this, of course, was in the 2010s, and that this movement was still alive and well, and people were still working and inspired to work on this topic.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, yeah, that's quite a vivid, you know, personal sense of how it sort of emerged as a theme. But sort of jumping back a few ticks to this general idea of the prominence of history or the importance of history. Your time in China has obviously been extremely extensive. You've mentioned, yeah, there just being a student, working as a journalist. I mean, was there a sense over that period or during your career that, you know, that there was something specific about history? Is this a thing that has been in your head for a long time? And how, over the sort of course of your time there, have you sort of responded to this idea that, you know, history matters, and one hears this plenty, you know, often enough in China itself?
Yeah, it was something that has been present for as long as I've been going to China, that the party essentially legitimizes its rule through history. And so, as you pointed out in the introduction, history matters in practically every country that I can think of, and certainly where I'm living right now in the United States. I always like to joke that people are still debating issues going back to the late Ming Dynasty. And this is, in other words, the 1619 project, the centrality of slavery in the forming of the United States. And these are hot button issues in this country as well. And of course, in the UK, elsewhere, the role of the empire and so on. So it's true that it's present everywhere. But I think in China, it's really central to how the government legitimizes its role. And, you know, this isn't just Xi Jinping, it's Deng Xiaoping in 1981-82 put out a resolution on history to legitimize why he had done a 180-degree turn from the Mao era, why he was ruling the country, to explain the debacles of the Mao era, etc. And so this is something that top leaders, at the most powerful leaders, let's say, in the history of the PRC, have relied on these kind of resolutions, these new interpretations of history to legitimize their rule. What I think was maybe interesting is in the 80s and 90s and even the 2000s, there was a sense that ordinary people, let's say, or people who were not partial in this, and that there was a more vibrant civil society effort at retelling history. There was a huge outpouring of documentary films, underground documentary films starting in the late 1990s, magazines, etc. And as with other things in society, civil society in general, let's say, the party began to wrap to tighten up again in the late 2000s and going into the Xi Jinping era. And this, in the centrality under Xi Jinping, really one of his signature policies has been reasserting, or trying to reassert, control over the historical narrative because of this feeling that it had slipped out of the government's control. And I think this back and forth is what I had witnessed, and this, that this battle was back again at the center, was what really interested me in the 2010s.
Well, actually, that leads on very smoothly to a starting point that I was envisaging having for our conversation about the actual content of the book, because in some respects it goes against the grain of the actual purpose of the book and the main themes to begin with these, you know, party narratives and, as you've said, the sort of legitimation through, you know, historical narrative that that the party seeks. But I guess, you know, since the main topic of the book is the people who are not part of that, or at least are quite consciously oriented against it. But I suppose, I wanted to ask, is it the case in your view that the current sort of Communist Party setup is trying to impose a tighter leash, a narrower frame on historical narrative than at any point in the recent past? Chapter 5 actually is where you start. So you actually provide some accounts of Xi Jinping's own background, his own sort of origin myth, and so on. So just, you know, just to sort of pin that down, is it your sense that this is a sort of unprecedented period of historical narrowing from the top down?
It's certainly unprecedented in this post-Mao era, let's say. Mao was a big believer, of course, in imposing the historical narrative on the population. In fact, you could look at one of the first major political campaigns in the PRC was the campaign against landlords. And this was, it's often overlooked. I think the centrality of it is sometimes not appreciated, but this was to sort of tell the story about how there had been this class of blood-sucking leeches, these landlords who had destroyed the average person's livelihood in China, and that these people, it ended up being a couple of million people, had to be killed in order for the new society to take root. And so early on, you had this historical narrative that China had been destroyed by this land-owning class. But I think, there was, again, this sort of relaxation in the 80s, 90s, and 2000s. And Xi Jinping, very early on, he took power in late 2012, and he took power by going to the National History Museum, the National Museum of China, going to this exhibition that lays out the party's mythic saving of China in 1949. And then the next year, in 2013, he essentially outlaws criticism of the Mao era with this policy of the two negations, the Liang Gefu Ding, that you can't negate the Mao era and be in favor of the reform era. You have to accept the Mao era. And there had been this, as I mentioned, this outpouring of the underground documentary films, Zamzdat style journals that were published regularly, hundreds of issues that looked at the Mao era and the disasters of it. And Xi was essentially saying, no, you can't do that anymore. And so I think in that sense, yes, under Xi, and for various reasons we could go into, he's seen that as a central battle that he has to fight.
Well, I think that topic in its own right, the kind of effort to wrest these two, I guess, pre-1978 or pre-Deng period of Chinese history and the post-Deng period up to the present into some kind of disciplined, narrow, single thread, you know, is in itself a fascinating kind of, I guess, historiographical exercise, but it's not necessarily the main focus of the book. Of course, you mentioned, I mean, intriguingly, as I say, in that chapter, History as a Weapon, on Xi's background, that Xi Zhongxun himself was someone involved in, that is, you know, Xi Jinping's father was sort of involved in some efforts to have a slightly more open attitude and maybe discuss in more frank detail some historical kind of issues that were becoming a bit more kind of discussed in that period of openness following the Mao era. But I think, you know, it does better justice to the actual focus of the book to get onto the people who are your primary interlocutors, as I say. So could you say in your own words, you know, I've already mentioned them, but maybe you would definitely explain them better. Who are these underground historians of the title?
Yeah, these are people who may hold a PhD in history, but most of them are, there are a fair number of academics who are involved in this, but few of them, or almost none of them, really can teach and write officially in their capacity in these topics. So in other words, there may be people who research the Cultural Revolution who have PhDs in history, but they don't teach that at the university. There's no chair in Cultural Revolution or in Great Leap Forward Studies or something like that. So you have people, you have some academics, you have a lot of people though who are probably autodidactic in the sense that they are not professional historians, they don't have academic training, but they felt it their calling to research a specific issue of importance to them, often something they experienced firsthand. There was one fellow, for example, who goes by the nom de guerre Tiger Temple, Lao Hu Miao, and his real name is Zhang Shehe. And he, in, as a youth in the Mao era, was forced to work on a railroad, as, along with many children, many miners who were essentially slaves who had to build this railroad to Yunnan from Xi'an. And this spurred him to then collect these oral histories on this project. And you see many stories like that, people who had a firsthand personal experience and they go on to work in this field. And even when they've exhausted their personal interest, they continue on to look at other aspects of history. But I think it's important to remember that these, maybe the term underground historian is a bit awkward. In Chinese, I would use the word minjian, which is more like unofficial or folk. But, you know, folk has the idea of maybe folksy or popular or something like that. I guess what I was trying to avoid was the word dissident, because I think when we think of dissidents, then we immediately think of somebody like Liu Xiaobo, who might have a very clear political agenda, trying to essentially overthrow or supplant the CCP with some sort of democratic structures. The people I write about often have one foot inside the system. They might want a more open China with a different political system, but they don't have a direct political agenda. They just hope to have more space to discuss these issues, and they don't have a well-formed set of ideas. And again, some of them are inside the system. Some of them are university professors, such as Ai Xiaoming, the feminist scholar turned documentary filmmaker. Mm-hmm. Who is retired from Zhongshan University in Guangzhou, and other people like that. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to sort of show that these aren't outliers. These aren't people holed up in their attic. These are people who own property, collect pensions, maybe have families and do other quote unquote normal things that people in other societies do.
Mm. Well, that's a great summary of these figures. I mean, I guess depending on what angle a reader comes at this book from, you know, and I guess this particular network is listened to more by people in that academic world that you've mentioned, you know, might be familiar with actually Yang Jisheng, who you've already mentioned, whose book Tombstone is obviously very important work on the Great Leap Forward famine. I mean, he's not actually a kind of particularly prominent focus of the book, despite being mentioned. But other figures, Tan Ho Chung, who you know, wrote about, I guess, a cultural revolution in the countryside, Fang Fang, who much more recently has written, you know, about Wuhan lockdowns, Tsering was you know, discussing Tibet during the Cultural Revolution, and so on. These are figures that may be, you know, quite familiar to scholars working on some of these themes. But I mean, you bring in, I think, a wide range of other figures, you know, who it's extremely profitable to kind of put in dialogue with these others, and regardless, as you say, of whether they are formally academics and so on. But yeah, I mean, you say you kind of wanted to avoid this sense of dissidence, and there are instances in which you mention those figures themselves rejecting that term, you know, not wanting to be considered in such light. But I guess you settled on historians, or I don't know if the publisher settled on historians. I mean, did you debate, was there any kind of other names in the frame for, or other labels in the frame for what these people might be called?
You could think of them as independent thinkers or something like that. The academic Sebastian Vegg calls them China's Minjian, or he just avoids translating the word, he just uses Minjian intellectuals, I think. So sort of like grassroots intellectuals might be another way of thinking of it, which is good. But then again, there are people in this group who are who are trained academics. So this is a wide variety of people. One of the people, the main characters, is Zhang Xue, a journalist from Tianshui in Gansu province. And she's written a lot of articles and books and stuff like, not books, written many long form journalism pieces and even done some short video work and so on and so forth. But they, these are all people who have also availed themselves of new digital technologies that rose up in the late 1990s to produce this. And I guess maybe that's one, that word of production justifies the word historians, because many of them do produce new historical knowledge in that they are making oral histories, they're gathering information that didn't exist before or giving new interpretations. So, you know, in that sense, you could call it a story.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Mm. No, well, it's a convincing and helpful frame, but one which, as I mentioned in the introduction, I think, you know, encourages us to think kind of more broadly about what history is. And that's a question, I think, relevant within the context that these people inhabit, too, because clearly there is a sort of authoritative historical truth that is legitimated by being in publications and in official media and in party kind of approved sources. I guess, you know, they might not so easily be dubbed historians within China per se, at least in the eyes of those authorities. I really liked your framing of the sort of ecology, if you like, of ideas or the space socially that they inhabit. In terms of the Jianghu, this term, rivers and lakes, literally. But could you kind of say something about that framing and that kind of idea? Because I found that very appealing, and maybe also helps us to understand who these people are.
Yeah. So if you go back in Chinese history, there are people who have done similar works. They're often called yesh, or like a wild or unofficial histories, literally being like wild. So these are people who are not part of the system. And the whole concept of Jianghu are kind of like knights errant, people who live by a code of conduct that they feel is a higher code that maybe they are upholding the true spirit of the civilization while the government is corrupt. So they're people who are not in the valleys practicing, say, settled agriculture. This is where the idea of Jianghu comes. They're out in the rivers and lakes. People in the, if you're familiar with the great Chinese classical novel, The Water Margin, or sometimes translated as All Men Are Brothers, these people who live by a code, who are ultimately upholding the true values of society. And this is, I think, how they see themselves, as outsiders who are fighting a guerrilla war. This is why, another reason for calling them underground, because I wanted to show this asymmetrical battle that they're engaged in. And this is, I think, what really inspires a lot of the people to they think of themselves in these terms. And it also helps them, I think, feel that they're not fighting such a hopeless struggle, that if you look back at Chinese literature, poetry, Chinese civilization writ large, these are the heroes, right? These people end up being justified by history. They're not the losers. The people who are the bad guys are the emperors, or the bad officials who oppress them. And that these people ultimately represent the true values of Chinese civilization, such as righteousness, justice, and other ideas like that.
Well, my own I guess hometown Nottingham has a hero that fits this profile quite closely. So, you know, again, if we're looking for generalities and parallels, then and Robin Hood is an inhabitant of the British Jianghu or the East Midlands Jianghu, just as these figures perhaps you know have a contemporary resonance with Shui Hu Zhuan, with Water Margin, and some of these classical tropes. So I think you know I found that a very convincing sort of a device, I guess, to discuss them. But given that they inhabit this space, as you said, you know, and maybe aren't recognized until later, I guess I'm also interested, sort of methodologically, if you like, in how you found these people, how you got to know them, and you know, what form your interactions took, given that they're, you know, sort of in a mix of locations, some working in universities, but others not.
I have the benefit of living in China for a prolonged period of time. When I went back to China around the time of the Olympics, I mentioned I was still working for a newspaper for the Wall Street Journal, and I quit in 2010 to go freelance. And my journalistic accreditation was picked up by the New York Times. And so officially I was a New York Times correspondent, but I was a freelancer. And that gave me a lot of freedom to work on these projects and pursue them over a period of time. So it was possible to, you know, you interview somebody like Yang Jisheng, and then it's typical journalistic practice, but probably any sort of researching practice, you ask the people you're talking to for more, other people you could go talk to, and it eventually snowballs. And then it's, over time, you begin to hear the same names over and over. And so you contact them and go see them and ask them, when are you next going out in the field to work on a project? And because I was there for a longer period of time, if they said I'm going in 2 months from now, then that was fine. If they said I'm going tomorrow, then more or less that would be fine. I also had some responsibility. I was teaching at a university there for one semester a year. So there were sometimes when I couldn't just drop everything and go, but overall I had a lot of freedom to go and follow them around. And I guess it just snowballed after a while. And you sort of then try to identify who are people, first of all, who are comfortable to be interviewed. You talk it over, the risks and so on and so forth. And then who are people who have some representative value? You want different kinds of people, different who represent different genres or different, some, you know, filmmakers and some magazine editors or authors and some book authors, etc. People from different parts of China. I think that's also important to try to capture some of the geographic diversity. So it wasn't, you know, all these people who I happened to have interviewed or something. I didn't use everything. In fact, as with a lot of these projects, of course, you just use a small portion of them. But I think I had the benefit of not being tied down to a newspaper job all the time. And therefore, I didn't have the responsibility of, say, covering everything Xi Jinping said or some foreign minister comes to visit or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. And as you mentioned, yeah, I mean, as a result, you do sort of browse far and wide. Geographically, that's an important factor that we'll return to in a second. But also, yeah, thematically, these figures are producing media and writing and art of a whole variety of different forms, which you kind of you know, move through and again bring it all into a very effective single historical frame. Part of the means by which you do that is the structure of the book, which is very interesting, divided broadly into three parts: past, present, and future, but also chapters that describe sort of specific instances or specific figures, interspersed with what are called these sort of memories, right? These individual, I guess, historical episodes. So could you sort of give us a better picture of why you decided to structure it like this, you know, kind of how you came up with that sort of way of planning it out?
Yeah, well, a book on history, past, present, and future isn't that original, I guess.
But, right.
The three sections are also geographic. So I thought of the book, first of all, geographically. I'm always fascinated by geography. And when I wrote the book on religion, the souls of China, I like to, you know, place things in their location. So the past chapters were mainly set in China's northwest. And in some ways, when you're thinking of the historiography of the PRC, it makes some sense because that's where the party had its wartime base in Yan'an, and where a lot of these historical battles were initially fought by Mao against some of his opponents, or imagined opponents at least. And then the present chapters were the chapters that might be considered to be in China proper, which is maybe a bit of a contested term, but it's the, let's think of it as the Ming Dynasty, the China from Beijing in the north to Yunnan or Guangzhou in the south, and Shanghai, the coast then to the Sichuan Basin. And this is the Han sort of center. And the future would be the extremities of China, because I think that this is a harder area to write about, the minority areas. I have one chapter called Empire, which is on the minority areas, but it's a harder area to research and write on, which I mentioned, you know, why, because of the erasure of so much of the history there, much more completely than in the Han areas. But then the idea of the extremities going to Hong Kong and abroad, because I think that's also where the battle now is also being fought, also now supported by Chinese communities abroad in different parts of the world. So there was some thought that I gave to that in terms of a big sort of flow of the book. And then the memories, these interpolations between the chapters, I tried to keep them to 2,500 words or so. So they were maybe, you know, five pages or something like that, four, five, six at the very most, I think, pages. And I thought of them, and initially I thought I would make them places of memory with the sort of Nora's idea of lieu de mémoire. But then I was influenced by this other theorist of history, or memory studies, Jay Winter, who talks about this idea of theaters of memory, that it's not just places like battlefields and things like that, but it's also movies and books. And this is also where history is fought over. So in the case of China, it's books by somebody like Gao Hua, the great late Nanjing historian, whose books are so influential, or the movies of Wu Wenguang, who has made a whole career of sending people back out to the countryside to make hand sort of made films on local history and so on and so forth. So these are, I think also part of the goal is to go to different parts of China and have different people. So the main chapters, I try to keep relatively tightly focused on a few main characters so that the reader doesn't get lost. But in the memory chapters, these are one-off stories. So it takes you to Dunhuang and you meet Gao Artai. But we don't go back to Gao Artai. So you don't have to sort of keep them in your mind when you're reading the rest of the book. But it's to show that this isn't just a few people. This is a broad group of people in many parts of China who are working on this project. And that was the goal of those memory sections.
Yeah, that combination of breadth and these sort of episodes in which, as we say, we do encounter specific figures, specific episodes, or theatrical settings, as you've just mentioned there, with the continuity that's present where there are certain figures, Ai Xiaoming, you've already mentioned, Jiang Xue, these kind of historians, if you know, under the terms of the book itself, who recur and you know, sort of pop up. And actually, you know, you mentioned there that this sort of past, present, future framing is not a giant leap in historiographical writing. But I don't know if I actually even particularly agree that really adequately describes the way the book, you know, the narrative of the book, because in fact there is so much depth and sort of bi-directional orientation to everything from the very beginning, if we take just a sort of linear past to future kind of way of thinking about it, that it sort of defies that sort of past, present, future. So if anything, you know, I was reading it at times thinking, are we actually moving through time here? You know, it's got so much more sort of going on than that. I mean, this is a personal pet theme of my own, so I won't go on about it at much greater length. I think it would sort of be interesting now to jump into some of the sort of specifics, and in this sort of first part, which, as you say, is both past but also is West China, the Lus Plateau, Xi'an, Gansu. There's a kind of, as you say, a sort of geographical resonance there, the seat, the birthplace of not only, I guess, the Chinese Communist Revolution, but the Qin Dynasty 2,000 years ago, and so on and so forth. One of the first sort of key episodes you describe is the Jiabiengo labor camp and Ai Xiaoming's filmmaking activities around that. But I wanted to move us forward actually to a slightly later chapter, which carries the same name as the book, Spark, and gives the book its title, the name of this journal. So could you tell us a bit more about this specific case of this journal, Spark, and you know, what it sort of tells us more broadly in light with the themes of the book.
This was a journal that was founded by students who had been caught up in the anti-rightist campaign, which is another campaign that's sometimes overlooked in our focus on things like the Cultural Revolution. But the anti-rightist campaign was an effort to silence China's newly emerged educated class of people who'd been to universities and things like that, people who had been part of this new system of higher education that had started in the 30s and 40s and so on. So this was Mao first encouraged people to speak out, and then anybody who spoke out was basically kneecapped. There up to about 600,000 people were designated rightists. And in a country at that time with a large percentage of the population was illiterate and not a very thick or big educated class, it was a huge percentage of the population. And so these students were involved in this, and they were exiled to, they were all from Lanzhou University. So they were sent to another part of Gansu, a small town called Tianshui, and they were sent to the suburb of Tianshui to work there. And they saw what happened next was the famine, of course, because the Great Famine, which killed up to 45 million people, by some estimates, I guess most estimates are 35 to 45 million. In any case, it was a terrible thing. They saw cannibalism. They saw the party not responding to it. And so they came up with this quixotic idea of starting a journal, which was something that they created by using a mimeograph machine, which is a quite crude technology, but some listeners may still be familiar with that from their childhood or youth or whatever. But it's a way of making copies of something by cranking it on a drum. They hand wrote the magazine. It wasn't sophisticated, it didn't have photos. It was basically just 8 pages, but it was quite prescient in the descriptions of the problems that faced China. They ascribed the famine correctly, really, to one person rule, and that nobody could stand up to Mao. They, at that point, they realized what had happened to people. Right up to Mao, Peng Dehuai, the marshal who was had tried to do that at the Lushan conference, they saw that he had failed, and they realized that this was part of the reason: the lack of freedom of speech and the lack of land ownership by farmers. Something that people sometimes forget is that every square inch of the People's Republic is owned by the state. And so farmers don't really own their land. They just have usage rights over their land. Back then, they didn't even have that. And so they had to follow every policy that the party pushed. And this is at the root of the famine. They had to follow this completely delusional economic policy, which led to the famine. So they wrote this up, they printed it, and they thought, we'll just send it off to party branches around the country. To make a long story short, the whole group was rolled up within a few months. About 43 people were sent to labor camps. 3 of them were ultimately executed. And that could have been the end of the journal. It could have been just another one of these hopeless efforts at resisting or analyzing what had gone wrong with the party. Because there were just several dozens of the magazine were published. It was not like it was sent out thousands of copies around China. No issues were extant outside of, they were all confiscated by the state. And the people went off to labor camps. And in the late 70s and early 80s, there was this effort to rehabilitate people. So it's to try to sort of make amends for what had happened in the Mao era. And one of the people who had been involved was this woman named Tan Chanshui. And Miss Tan had, her boyfriend was the founder of the magazine and was one of the people executed. She was able to look in her personnel file, which is something that exists on basically every Chinese person. It may have banal things like your high school test scores or your driver's license information or something. But if you have a criminal record, it would have your criminal record in your personnel file, your dangan. And she looked in this, and she had access to it for a whole day, and the people in the office basically didn't pay any attention to her. So she pulled out a camera and photographed every page of her file. And there were 500 pages in the file, including all of the police records, the back issues of the magazine, all the confessions of the students, even the love letters that she'd written to her boyfriend while they were in detention, all of this she had. And then she took a bit with her back to Shanghai, where she was now retired and living. and just sat around in her apartment. And, you know, some people heard about it, and some other sufferers, people from the Spark group had heard about it, but nobody could do anything with it until the late 1990s with the advent of simple digital technologies such as the PDF. And the PDF allows you to take this information and republish it, essentially. Mm-hmm. So you could then, with these photographs, you can recreate the magazine Spark. You can put together all the confessions, the whole complete police dossier, and begin to email it to people. And this is what happened. And it began to snowball. And this is really, it's not just this magazine, but other things were happening similarly at the same time. The recreation of lost historical documents and magazines and essays and books and stuff, and also the production of new historical knowledge. People who were inspired by this and making their own journals and their own movies. And so the great independent filmmaker, Hu Jie, he's inspired by this and makes a classic documentary film in about 2003 called Searching for Lin Zhao's Soul, which is, Lin Zhao is a poet. She contributed poems to the magazine Spark. So he's doing things like that. And people in the public, other public intellectuals in China were sort of shocked by this. The film critic Sui Wei Ping in Beijing, a translator of Havel and others into Chinese, she said, now we have our genealogy. In other words, now we know our lineage. We now know that there are people before us, a generation earlier, struggling with similar issues. And you begin to see that you're not alone. You have historical precedents or people before you, ancestors, in other words, who were fighting the same fight. So just as there are people hundreds of years ago who did this, there were people in the history of the PRC who were also doing that. And that's a powerfully inspiring idea to have. And I think it was sort of that's how I date the modern underground history or folk history or whatever movement to the late 90s with these basic digital technologies, PDF and digital cameras, which allows anyone to make a documentary film. And that's sort of the significance of the magazine Spark as a symbol for this, the creation of this movement.
Not sure, yeah. And it's that sort of resonance, yeah, through different media and so on that kind of contributes, I think, to what I mentioned earlier about this sort of trans-temporal sort of leaping that is, you know, always a part, because you're telling some of these older stories about activities in the 50s and 60s through the lens of people finding out about it or researching it or you know, making informal documentaries and so on in subsequent decades, including Hu Jie, who also is a sort of recurrent persona in the book, and whose etchings also appear, woodblock kind of prints and so on. You know, someone who's, I guess, one of these autodidacts that you referred to earlier, someone who's contributed a huge amount, obviously, to this. And I guess in the field of publications, in part two, which focuses more directly on those pushing against the contemporary sort of Xi Jinping-led, official historical amnesia, you document the activities of a journal called Remembrance based just in the suburbs of Beijing, and you know, their sort of small scale kind of efforts to not stand out too much and kind of be able to carry on perhaps in this lineage. But I was curious too about another episode in part two, a couple of chapters earlier than that, The Lost City, chapter 8, in which you discuss these kind of meetings, a couple of figures, a citizen journalist, Zhang Shehe, and a historian, Chen Hongguo, who you say for a few years was giving these lectures in a place in Xi'an where people were coming together and discussing things. So this seems another form of you know, sharing and distributing, disseminating this kind of historical knowledge at a small scale. Could you say something about those activities, these kind of in-person dimension to historical transmission?
That's a really important point, because I think the mistake that a lot of people make is they focus too much on things like social media. And so when I say digital technologies, I'm always quick to say it's the simple early digital technologies that empower the people to enable them to create, but it's not the social media per se, which, as we all know, is easily controlled by the government. But it's, and so what really causes the spread of this is the person-to-person contacts. So there was in Xi'an up until just a few years ago, this public space called I Know I Know Nothing from the Socratic aphorism. And they use that. It's called Juru Jur in Chinese. And this was a nice little ecosystem, and it shows the potential for civil society in China under a slightly less authoritarian leader than Xi Jinping, which could easily come back. They had lectures on things like films like King Lear, but also they invited these independent Chinese intellectuals to come and give talks, show their films, etc. It looked a bit like a library, but it isn't really a library or a bookstore. It's just a space. They do have some books for sale and some other things like that. But it was a nice ecosystem of people. Chen Hongguo, who had been a legal law professor and who went off on his own. It's also interesting, that group of people often ask me about faith and what motivates people. Chen Hongguo was a Christian. In some ways, he's motivated a bit by Christianity, but Zhang Xue, the citizen journalist we mentioned before, is one of the main characters in the books, and who's from Xi'an, she's from Tianjin, but she lived in Xi'an and was part of this group. She is a Buddhist and also motivated by Buddhist ideas. So people have different motivations, but I think the main motivation is almost this, you know, religion of history, and this idea that you've got to spread the information as much as possible. It was a very interesting and inspiring group. Of course, it did get closed down in about 2018 or 2019.
I see. And so they were kind of discussing historical topics. I mean, who were the attendees? You do describe your own sort of, field work, basically hanging out with these people for a period of time. I mean, were the participants in this sort of general interested members of the public? Were they fellow more of the intellectual strand? I mean, who's actually going to some of these things?
Well, there were people who were intellectuals and so on. There was one person I met who was a business person. He wanted to support it, and he donated money to the group because he felt that he'd profited so much from the reform era that he wanted to give something back to other people who were pushing independent thought. There was a police officer I talked to who was quite an interesting guy, and he said, "Oh, I'm in security." And I said, "Oh, do you mean like guarding buildings?" And then he pointed to his shoulder and he said, "No." And then he said in English, "Police." And I'm like, "Oh, are we all busted?" And he said, "Oh, but I'm just here on my own. I think what's wrong with having some discussions?" And that to me was interesting, because I think we sometimes tend to have this Manichaean binary black and white view of the good guys in the underground and the bad guys in the government. But it's important to realize that inside the system in China, there are people who want more reforms, who think that keeping a lid on everything all the time is not really a way to true stability in society, that it just leads to more tensions, and that discussion groups like this can actually lead to fewer tensions. And so he was just an interested person who could take away some things from it. And he gave me an anecdote of how in dealing with a Muslim member of society who was carrying a knife, he was trying to just be a halal butcher, he gave the guy a warning and took him off the bus, but didn't bust him, you know, which in that context of 2018, 2019 China would have been the easy solution to do, and the way they probably would have got him a commendation. But here he was trying to take a page out of these lectures on tolerance and stuff like that to treat this person in society with a little bit more thought. And that shows, I think, the potential for these kinds of groups and the kinds of people who live there.
And I guess it's another side to the breaking down of that, I guess, as you said, Manichaean binary, to sort of point out that there are people within the system who maybe don't favor absolutely everything that's going on, just as those outside the system are not necessarily trying to violently overthrow the current situation. I mean, as you've already mentioned, whether it's earlier in the Mao period or more recently, many of them have more modest goals, not toppling anything, but trying to reform and trying to that kind of make the party more gentle, even if it's not even if it's still in power, or to restore individual dignity to figures from the past, rather than making any sort of grand political point. So I think you kind of that graded sense of a society, right? That even under these pretty grim circumstances, and we shouldn't shy away from those authoritarian realities, is operating as societies do, and people are being people. That's a very banal way of putting it, but I think it's something that's a real sort of source of the richness of the book. And as you've said too, it's a story that's far more complicated than just, oh, the internet came and suddenly everyone could do things. You know, that there's the in-person dimension, there's the subtlety and the complexity around what some of these technologies afford. But coming up, to more recent times, perhaps, or at least the sort of future-oriented final part of the book, and a new technological era in many ways when it comes to surveillance and particular use of certain social media platforms. You do, as you say, discuss some of the, outside the core inner China, Nadi, central Ming China, whatever you want to call it, and discuss Tibet and Cultural Revolution era Tibet in relation to Tsering Wurzler and her father, who has this documentary cache of photos from the Cultural Revolution there. But I was interested to hear a bit more about Hong Kong in particular, which you very intriguingly describe as a kind of Jianghu in its own right, on the fringes, you know, sort of at the edge, if you like, of empire. So how has your experience in part of the last few years and what's, unfolded in Hong Kong and your contact with some of these figures unfolded and sort of contributed to your view of what these historians are up to and what they can do these days?
Yeah, so that's in a way why those three sections, it's sort of the past is in a way the past way that history was dealt with, and the current was sort of how things have been done up until recently, and the future is my effort at looking at how things will develop into the future. As maybe wrong, but the role of Hong Kong used to be central to this independent history movement in China. That's where a huge number of books were published. It was a place, there was this place called the University Service Center at CUHK, which had been founded in the 1960s by Western academics who wanted a place to go. When they couldn't get into China, they could go there and read books on China and interview refugees coming from China and so on and so forth, right? But when China opened, this service center turned into a wonderful resource for Chinese historians who were went to Hong Kong. It was easier to get to Hong Kong, not only because the visa was easier to get, but financially and so on. And they could use all this material that was in the University Service Center. Gao Hua, the great independent historian from Nanjing I mentioned, he did a lot of his work on the Mao era there at the University Service Center. This was, they had a fantastic website called the Folk History Project. All of this was closed down after 2019 when there were the protests and then the imposition of the national security law in Hong Kong in 2020, which made all of this illegal. As we know, there were efforts earlier even to close down independent bookstores, the booksellers, etc. And then the publishers began to close also. So I had this one vignette which follows that chapter, one of the memory vignettes where Bao Pu, who is the publisher of New Century Press, he called me up and said, there are all these copies of our books and other publishers' books in these warehouses. And now the warehouse owners are scared that even just holding these books will violate the national security law. So can you take some of these books off my hands? I have somebody who will pay the shipping costs. So at the time, I was working at the Council on Foreign Relations, and I said, sure, shipped all the books, about 600 books he sent to the council's offices, and then I arranged to have them sent to libraries, to research libraries in different parts of the world, and other people made similar efforts. It wasn't just me, it was other people who were doing similar things. So the idea was to preserve these books from being pulped, but it shows, I think, maybe more broadly, how this movement has moved or is now, at least it has a leg outside of China. So the magazine you mentioned before, Remembrance, GE, that magazine is still written by people primarily inside China, but it's published with the help of overseas Chinese, especially grad students, and Chinese grad students, but living abroad. So they do some of the editing, the back-end work. They've also given it an ISBN number and allowed it to be published in the West in paper format, which allows it to be put in libraries and things like that. So this is, in some ways, if you want to think of it like a planet that's under attack, these are kind of pods that have been sent out to other planets in hope that some of this will be saved and maintained. Almost all the people I write about, the movie makers, for example, put their films up on YouTube or elsewhere. And it inspired me to start this website called the China Unofficial Archive, which is a charitable organization. It's a platform for all of these books, magazines, and films. So what I've noticed living now for the first time in a long, long time back in the West, I've been living in New York for the past 2.5 years, is the number of young Chinese people who are really interested in these issues in a way that I don't think was really the case in the past. People, especially overseas, who are trying to help, who are in contact with people back in China, despite the fact that China is an authoritarian state, and more authoritarian than ever, let's say, but it's still very permeable. There's still thousands and thousands of people going back and forth between China and abroad. So we see this movement of people getting support by overseas Chinese communities, be they in Taiwan or Japan, Korea, North America, Europe as well.
And that, I guess, gives us, a quite convenient point at which to sort of wrap up the conversation broadly in terms of the motivations, the faith you've already mentioned that sort of really drives forward some of these people against all the odds and has done for many decades. As a sort of final question on the book itself, and you've already sort of alluded to this somewhat, but what do you think it is that sort of really is the value as the historians themselves see it of documenting this stuff, despite the fact that, of course, although there are many of them, and more than one might expect, as the book shows, they're still extremely marginal, not heard by the vast majority of the Chinese population. What do you think they understand to be the real value of this, beyond a sort of act of conscience, or maybe it is primarily an act of conscience or objection of some kind? What do you think that sort of comprises?
I think they see themselves as, they're realistic. I mean, they realize they're not going to be on WeChat discussion groups in the near future. They're not going to have Weibo accounts or be put in, et cetera, et cetera, or taught in elementary school curriculum, et cetera. But they see themselves as sending out, in a way, messages in a bottle to the future, to future generations of Chinese people, to show that there were people active in Xi's China who were still trying to do things. They're trying to also get eyewitnesses on the record before they pass away. This is why I think the oral history aspect of it is so central to what many of them do. And this is, in some way, I think what motivated me was to show that despite the conventional wisdom in the West, that China is like this perfect dictatorship, that nothing can happen, that this doesn't exist anymore, that it's all been erased, that actually there are people in China, there is independent thought in China. And that if we're trying to engage with China, and I think there's many people in the West who don't want to engage with China at all or have anything to do with China, because they think of it as a vast wasteland where the CCP has completely dominated the landscape and there's nothing more to do except watch Xi Jinping consolidate power indefinitely in the future. I wanted to challenge that and say, no, there are actually people doing things in China. There are people with whom we can engage. Mm-hmm. We can talk to these people. And I have in the conclusion, a bit of a plea to civil society in the West to do more to make people aware of these people. There's a great website set up called the China Independent Film Archive, set up by people from Newcastle University. and others. It's called ChinaIndieFilm.org, and they document a lot of these independent films. Also, I mentioned the China Unofficial Archives, but I set up. But I think that, you know, we should try to invite them to more film festivals. We should try to have a retrospective. I mean, why? And think big, you know, why can't we push the big film festivals to have a retrospective on somebody like Hu Jie or Ai Xiaoming, invite people over for fellowships and so on. There are problems, but with language, most of the people I interview don't speak English. So there clearly would be some issues if they were coming over as a guest professor or something. But I think we should try to do more. And it kind of irritates me that a generation ago, Westerners, educated people, at least in the West, were so much more familiar of the similar people from Eastern and Central Europe, like Solzhenitsyn or Kundera or Milos Forman and so on. But they don't really know the Chinese counterparts. And I don't know, there are various reasons one could go into for that. But I think in some ways in the West, we just sort of ignore this or think that they're completely hopeless, irrelevant, or marginalized in a way that makes them unimportant, that we can just write them off. But I don't think they are. I think change, and I think they see this also, that change in any society starts small, and that even in their lifetime, some of these heroes of the past, like Sima Qian, et cetera, were marginalized, were the losers. But in the long run, they were the winners. And so I think we shouldn't always assume that people who are small and marginalized now will always be marginalized. History can change. Just maybe it was naive a generation ago to have a straight line projection of China going off into the future and getting more and more open. I think it's equally naive now to have a straight line projection that China will only become more and more authoritarian. Mm-hmm. People that I write about in the book, or similar people to them, can have a role to play in a future China. And we shouldn't think that they don't exist or that they don't matter.
Right. And I guess thinking that they don't is voluntarily subordinating yourself to the same sort of authoritarian and historically effacing dynamic that you're supposedly complaining about. If you're saying, oh, she's China, is this right, and that and the rest, you know. But it's interesting, yeah, as you mentioned, that I guess the last time that there was interest in some of these figures may have been around the same period that Solzhenitsyn or Kundera or these figures came to prominence, i.e. the late 80s and early 90s, the Tiananmen moment in China, which intriguingly, and I'll leave this as a sort of cliffhanger for people to read the book if they haven't yet, that, you know, some of your interlocutors in the book do had mixed feelings at the time about Tiananmen, and sort of it's part of this bigger complexity. Things aren't actually just a story of resistance and protest versus, overweening authority. It's a far more nuanced tale that you've told. In any case, Ian, thank you so much for talking to us today. We've taken up plenty of your time. But before we go, you've mentioned, as you've said, that you're outside China and have been for the recent period of time. What have you been up to? What are you looking at doing in the near future? Is your interest in history continuing? What's happening?
Well, my interest in history is so strong that I am working on a PhD now at Leipzig University with Philip Clart. I'm going to be finishing that off. I did all the field work while I was in China, but I'll be writing about these religious associations and their role in Xi Jinping's China. And I'll be a fellowship for the 2024-2025 academic year at the Wissenschaftskolleg in Berlin. And then probably will be just staying on in Berlin, or where I've lived before in my life, and have permanent residency there. So we'll stay there and I'll keep working on these topics. I'll keep running the China Unofficial Archives, which is this Minjian Dangangguan, and we'll try to just keep giving a platform to Chinese independent historians, and maybe try to get them to come over to some of our film festivals or book festivals and things like that.
Fantastic. Well, that sounds like a really worthy and brilliant continuation of the project that is so brilliantly represented in Sparks. And I should say, too, that there's a lot of resources in the back of the book itself, too, for people wanting to look at some of these things that have been mentioned. But in the meantime, Ian Johnson, I really want to thank you again for being on the show today. It was great talking to you.
Thank you. It's been wonderful talking with you.
Listeners, thank you too for listening, as ever, to the New Books in East Asian Studies podcast. It's a program on the New Books Network, and it will be back with you again very soon. Goodbye.